This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're jumping into the Christmas season with Krampus. I'm also going to be talking about Carol, The Letters, and Brooklyn, which has been out for a couple weeks, but it's worth mentioning now still. I'll also talk about the news, the trailer park, I've got a listener voicemail, and of course, box office predictions and the home cinema roundup. But before that, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Jumping right into the news, Ron Burgundy, let's talk about one piece of news that kind of sent people into a tizzy because award season is in full swing. We already have awards being announced with New York Film Critics Circle and, more importantly, the National Board of Review, which came out and named Mad Max Fury Road as the best picture. And look, I enjoyed Mad Max Fury Road. I appreciated the action in a big way. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's a great, exciting movie to watch. Best of the year? I think you've got a long argument to make. I'm sure that there are certain fanboys out there who think it is one of the best of the year, and I'm sure you're going to see it showing up on people's top 10 lists. But this just feels like the award season equivalent of clickbait headlining, which unironically led to tons and tons of clickbait headlines. The problem I have with this is I don't think it's a genuine vote. Now, you can go get the list of the National Board of Review. I actually got sent an email press release, and they have the list of people, and I know some of them on the list. But look, you can't complain that, like, The Tourist got nominated for the Golden Globes and not complain that Mad Max won Best Picture at the National Board of Review. Because if you go to the National Board of Review's own website, it says their process. And this is what they say. Each year, over 250 films are viewed by this select group of film enthusiasts, filmmakers, professionals, academics, and students. These screenings are frequently followed by in-depth discussion with directors, actors, producers, and screenwriters. Okay, first of all, the list that I was sent of the members did not include filmmakers or film enthusiasts or academics. They were all people that are associated with the publication. Those are the journalists who didn't have a problem putting their name on it. How many of these members are not named in here? And then we don't even know what their process is. I know everybody campaigns during award season, but if you read their own description of how they do this, basically they invite people to come in and tell them why their movie's great. So, oh, great, we had George Miller come in, and we all got a chance to meet George Miller, and he got to tell us how awesome he was and how awesome his movie was. And you don't know what their process is. I'm involved in three critics groups. Everyone knows the process. You nominate, you vote on those nominations, and they go, you don't sit there and get in a big group and get wine and dined by the studios for it. So let's approach this with a certain level of skepticism. Don't expect Mad Max to suddenly become the big movie of the year and take the Oscar. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is London Has Fallen. Now, this one comes out March 4th, and it's a sequel to Olympus Has Fallen, and of course, it takes place in London.
Five of the world's leaders are now dead. The American president is unaccounted for.
Bakawe.
Number 6 on the 10 list.
What do you want?
Your president.
That's not going to happen. We have to find Bakawe before he finds the president.
We're going to kill him slowly and broadcast it live.
Yeah, well, you should have brought more men.
I gotta admit, this one looks really fun. This looks like a great explosive action flick. I don't think it's trying to be the beginning and end of action movies. And it's got a new director. who I don't recognize. Antoine Fuqua directed the first one, and I really like his stuff. I think he's a great director. This one looks like it's doing exactly what you need to do for a March action movie. Gerard Butler looks like he might actually save some face from his Egyptian movie that's coming out. Aaron Eckhart, I thought he was kind of a weak link in the last movie. But, you know, you've got Morgan Freeman, who's, I guess, again, taking over as president in this time of crisis. It looks like it's going to be a fun movie. I'm excited for it. The next one is also a March action film, and that is Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice. Opens March 25th. The second trailer dropped this week on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, who I hate with a passion, but it's worth talking about the trailer.
Civil liberties are being trampled on in your city. People living in fear. He thinks he's above the law.
The Daily Planet criticizing those who think they're above the law is a little hypocritical, wouldn't you say? Considering every time your hero saves a cat out of a tree, you read a puff piece editorial about an alien who could burn the whole place down.
Most of the world doesn't share your opinion, Mr. Wayne.
Maybe it's the Gotham City in me. Have a bad history with freaks dressed like clowns.
Boys! Bruce Wayne meets Clark Kent. I love it. I love bringing people together. How are we?
Lex.
Hi, hello. Lex, it is a pleasure. Ow, wow, that is a good grip. You should not pick a fight with this person.
There's a lot more to the trailer. There's a lot more action sequences to it, and you can go online and find it. It's all over the place. Here's the problem I have with this trailer. This feels almost desperate in its whimsical nature. The tonal shift between not just Man of Steel, but the previous film and this movie seems almost alarming. And it's not that I have a problem with a more whimsical movie, but it seems almost at odds with what they've shown us already, which to me feels like Warner Brothers scrambling to escape the early criticisms that are already out there that the series is going way too dark. Look, Henry Cavill's fine as Superman. I don't think he's great, but I think he works. And Ben Affleck, I think he's okay in the trailer. I actually buy him as Bruce Wayne. But my God, Jesse Eisenberg as Luthor is possibly the worst portrayal of Lex Luthor I've ever seen in my life. He's never been this in the comics. He's never been like this at all. This reminds me of when they were talking about Fantastic Four coming out earlier this summer, and they said they're just going to make Dr. Doom a blogger. That's what I get the feeling Jesse Eisenberg is in this movie. He's playing the Joker, is what he's playing. And that was part of the problem, well, one of the many problems with the Batman series that came prior to Christopher Nolan's. Every character, no matter who it was trying to play the Joker, was trying to out-goof the Joker or the Riddler, and it just plays really false. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg, just listen to him in that trailer. Ugh. And then also there's a reveal of Wonder Woman, which looks terrible. I mean, yeah, it's kind of cool, but Gal Gadot still hasn't sold me on it. I mean, she looks like she's been digitally put into this. Like, they didn't actually have her on set, that they just took costume photos and digitally put that face, wrapped it around a digital wireframe and made the, it doesn't even look like she's on set. And then they have this reveal of Doomsday, which, I mean, it's already starting to feel crowded. They haven't even talked about Aquaman yet. Gotta remember, this was supposed to be a Man of Steel sequel. And it's turning into getting ready for the Justice League. Whereas, like, the Avengers, it took, like, 5 movies to get to Avengers. Then it took a bunch more movies to get to Avengers 2. And they still had a couple movies before they can get to Captain America Civil War. They look like they're going straight to Captain America Civil War without the equity of, like, how many years? 7 years of making movies? They did one movie and they're stampeding towards Captain America Civil War. I've said before, and I'll say it again, the DC Cinematic Universe is unproved. Who knows? This could be the greatest movie of next year. It may be. I've been proved wrong before, seeing terrible trailers and having them turn out to be a pretty good movie. In fact, I'm going to be talking about one of those movies today. But I am still not sold on Batman vs. Superman. Now, we'll see in March. It might be great. It could be awesome. Who knows? Maybe I'll love it. But the trailers, every time there's something good, there's something bad that I don't like. Anyways, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to jump into the movie reviews with Krumpus and the letters. personal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews. It's Christmas time. It is the first weekend of December. It is time to shamelessly celebrate the Christmas season because, you know, we can sort of sneak that in earlier in November, right after Halloween. But you always felt a little guilty that the turkeys weren't getting their day. Of course, I think the turkeys were okay with that. They were ready to put off Thanksgiving as much as they can. But now it's Christmas season. It's Christmas time. So let's talk about the first official Christmas release. I'm not counting the ones that came out last month because, like I said, turkeys. Let's talk about Krampus, the tale of an anti-Santa who punishes the naughty at Christmas, is told in this holiday horror movie.
We heard something on the roof.
Saint Nicholas is not coming this year. Instead, a much darker ancient spirit.
Those are hooves. Elk or a goat?
What kind of goat walks on its hind legs?
His name is Krampus.
I personally kind of love the fact that the first big Christmas release after Thanksgiving is a horror movie. And a pretty dark horror movie as well. It's billed as a horror comedy. And while it has some pretty funny moments to it, it's a bona fide horror movie. It's a dark comedy in the darkest way possible. It's funny. It's PG-13. I thought it was R going into it. Now, it's directed by Michael Dougherty, who's most famous for doing Trick or Treat, which came out, 7 or 8 years ago. That was the anthology movie, takes place on Halloween, and it had a great list of stars. It had people like Leslie Bibb was in it, Anna Paquin, it had Brian Cox, it had Dylan Baker in it. It had a lot of names and very least recognizable faces, people you've seen in other movies. And it was one of these fantastically done anthology films, which hasn't been repeated. I mean, Tales of Halloween this year was pretty strong, but it still wasn't as good as Trick or Treat. Trick or Treat was one of these movies that got sort of sidelined by the studio because Warner Brothers produced it, and then they pulled it from big theatrical release, and I think part of it was because there's a lot of violence. That one's a dark movie as well, and some very unpleasant things happen to people of all ages, we'll say. And I think that played into the fact that they didn't want to have that violence of a film out there. So it went to VOD and DVD, and it's kind of become a perennial favorite now. People love this movie. So his new film is a take on a Christmas tale, which is, of course, the tale of Krampus goes back to legends in German folklore and the surrounding countries about a spirit that is there to take care of the naughty, just as Santa is there to take care of the nice. Krampus was kind of forgotten in sort of the popular culture, and it's been revived over the last couple of years. I remember Dwight Schrute's character from The Office dressed up as Krampus for Christmas during that show's run, and there was another Krampus movie a couple weeks ago that was a Christmas horror tale, which was basically a smackdown between Santa and Krampus. This one reminds me a bit of Rare Exports, because I think that draws a bit from the Krampus tales as well. But this is a really creepy movie, and it's not a complex movie. It's not, you know, it's not tightly written like Trick or Treat, because it had so many stories and they're all interwoven. It was really kind of an intricate film from a writing standpoint. This is very straightforward. You know, it's a family that is horrible to each other, and families lost its Christmas spirit, and they kind of go beyond where they should be in the holidays, and Krampus comes along to punish them. And he punishes everybody. And it kind of ultimately becomes this cabin in the woods story that takes place in the suburbs because they're cut off from everybody else by a snowstorm and loss of power. And the rest of the neighborhood is like either on vacation or they're being attacked by Krampus himself. It's a pretty creepy movie. I wouldn't take your kids to it. I mean, seriously, don't take a 5-year-old to this movie, because if you do, you're going to have the most awkward conversation on the ride home since Gremlins as a Christmas movie. This is a grown-up film, and it's PG-13, but that does not mean that it's appropriate for little kids. It's scary, and it gets ludicrous and silly at times, but it's very effective, and it's hard-hitting, and it's very intense throughout. It actually keeps its energy up, and that makes it a fun movie, and it's kind of thrilling to watch. It's got some great special effects. It's got some great performances by like Adam Scott and David Koechner and Toni Collette. They do a good job in this movie, and there's a one part in there where I was like, oh, I thought it was going to go in one direction, and I was a little disappointed, but things all worked out. This guy knows what he's doing, especially when it comes to the horror genre. So yeah, if you just want Peace on Earth, Goodwill to Men, and a nice little Hallmark holiday movie, don't go see this. But if you want a scary, creepy, weird alternative take on Christmas, check this one out, because Krampus rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Letters. This is a smaller release by Freestyle Releasing in, I think it's like 800 theaters around the country. So you can find it here and there. It's around. But it is a much more of an art house type film. The life of Mother Teresa is told in this subdued biopic.
Dear Father Van Exem, never in all my life did I know there was such suffering in the world as I have seen here.
On the train, the voice was very clear. I must leave the solace of the convent and give my life to serve the poorest of the poor.
Sister, it's not safe for you to be out here. These people are hungry, desperate.
You know, cloistered nuns cannot go outside the walls.
But I must do something.
The thing with Mother Teresa is, unless you really paid attention to her life, like if you're a real pious Catholic and you read everything that was written about her, most people just know that she was the closest thing to a living saint that we had at the time. I think she passed away in, 1997? But most people don't really know the story of Mother Teresa, and so this is where the value of this movie comes in. It's a very well-acted movie. I mean, obviously, for somebody like me, I grew up, I'm in my 40s, and Mother Teresa died almost 20 years ago, I think. Mother Teresa always was this old woman to me on the news that I would see, so I never lived through her regular story of how she got there. And very few people of media influence witnessed her story. Early on, a lot of people witnessed it because they were being helped, because she served the poorest of the poor in Calcutta. But it's a nice eye-opening look at Mother Teresa. And it has some good performances in supporting roles by Max von Sydow, who almost looks like Father Marin at this point. I mean, when he did The Exorcist 40 years ago, he had makeup to look this old, and now he looks this old in a priest outfit. You also have Rutger Hauer playing a hobo with a shotgun who shows up. Well, he's a priest. I'm assuming he left his job as a hobo with a shotgun to become a priest. They got smaller parts. It's really the focus on Mother Teresa and the journey she takes from being a cloistered nun to going out on her own and helping the poorest of the poor and finding a way to do it. If you have any interest in Mother Teresa, check this one out. It's not exactly a hard-hitting piece. It's very steadily directed. It's not something that hits hard and doesn't have big action scenes and doesn't have big dramatic moments. It's very deliberate and subdued, and it feels a little bit like a TV movie in that respect, but it's still good. I mean, it's for people who want to know about Mother Teresa, and that's who it's for. And ultimately, in that respect, I have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Brooklyn and Carol. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Let's talk about some award contenders. These are big movies. Both of them have actually been out for a couple weeks. Not in wide release. Well, Brooklyn has been in wide release. Carol, which I'm going to talk about later, has been kind of in limited release. It's trickling out throughout December. But these are worth talking about because you're going to hear these throughout award season. You're already hearing stuff. I mean, Brooklyn and Carol have both gotten nominations and some awards already from these very, very early awards. So let's talk about Brooklyn. A young Irish woman travels to Brooklyn to start a new life, but finds her heart drawn back home.
Dear Rose, I miss you and Mother and think about you every day. I wish that I could stop feeling that I want to be an Irish girl in Ireland.
Homesickness is like most sicknesses. It will pass. Baby,
baby, I met somebody.
I want to ask you something, and you're going to say, oh, it's too soon. Will you come for dinner and meet my family?
I'd love to.
You like Italian food?
I remember seeing this trailer in front of 90 Minutes in Heaven, which was a just awful movie. Brooklyn was shown in there, and I got to admit, the trailer for this movie is pretty terrible. In fact, when I saw this trailer, I was like, oh, who wants to watch that? It looked really corny and cheesy and schmaltzy. Maybe part of it's the music and you know, obviously I only played a little bit of the trailer there, but it just didn't quite click. But then I started hearing a lot of buzz for this. And Saoirse Ronan has gotten some real accolades for this, and deservedly so. She's pretty fantastic in the film. Saoirse Ronan kind of came on strong with Atonement a couple years ago when she was like 13. I mean, she's in her 20s now, and she's taken some time to find her footing. She went through her teenage years making movies. She did movies like Hannah, which was good. She was in her awkward stage during Hannah. And other movies like she was in The Grand Budapest Hotel last year, and I thought that was a great movie. But this one, I think, is really her coming to her own as an adult actress. This is a grown-up movie, but it's very charming, and it's very sweet. It's beautifully acted. She's fantastic in it. And the reason she's fantastic is because she doesn't grandstand. That's what makes her role in this so good. The movie is not filled with Oscar clips for her. When she gets her Oscar nomination, which she will, you're definitely going to find plenty of things you can play during the ceremony, but it doesn't feel that way. It's just a very even performance, and she's not going Hollywood. She goes very natural. I was watching with my wife and I said, she's fair in this movie. Fair meaning beautiful. But she's not beautiful in the sense like Angelina Jolie, especially you want to compare it to something like By the Sea, which is just nothing but Angelina Jolie's ego vomiting on the screen for 2 hours. And it's just her saying, look how gorgeous I am. And oh, but it's okay because I'm the character's supposed to be vain. And it's not vain of me to then make a vain movie about myself. In this one, you don't think Saoirse Ronan's trying to go for a glamour shoot. She just looks very pretty and very attractive, but very approachable. That you know, she's Irish. That's that fair Irish look. Her character in this movie is not one that's immediately going to turn heads, but then you look at her and you go, wow, she really is quite a beauty. And that's just how she looks. That's not even getting into her acting. But what I'm saying is that part of the personality in the movie goes into the acting. Like I said, she doesn't grandstand in this. She just performs extremely well. It's a very charming movie. It's not a tearjerker wrenching your emotion. It's not like something like Suffragette, which just beats you over the head constantly. This one is just the story of a woman. And her experiences, good and bad, some very emotional, but nothing that just crushes her and destroys her. It's not extreme. It's a very charming, wonderful movie. So I'm going to have to say Brooklyn totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Carol. Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara play two women caught up in a love affair that threatens to ruin their lives in the 1950s.
Therese Bellevet.
Carol.
Tell me you know what you're doing.
I never did. And then it changed.
She's still my wife. I love her.
I can't help you with that.
It shouldn't be like this.
I know. If he can't have me, I can't see my daughter.
A couple months ago, I remember hearing kind of like a get ready for award season because there's going to be a lot of issue-driven films. There always are issue-driven films in award season. And different years are different films. Like, I remember 12 Years a Slave, obviously. The issue was white guilt over slavery, which is part of the reason why Selma didn't stand a chance the next year, because the Academy's like, we had our white guilt last year. We're going to do something else. We're going to go artistic with Birdman. This year, a lot of the end-of-the-year films and the award contenders have dealt with LGBT rights. Whether you're talking about Freeheld, the one where Julianne Moore and Ellen Page play lesbian lovers who are dealing with survivorship issues, whether you're talking about The Danish Girl, which is dealing with transgender issues, or whether you're dealing with Carol, which deals with a lesbian love affair back in the 50s, where let's just say that society wasn't nearly as accepting. Not that society at times is not very accepting of lesbians and gays now, but overall society is much more accepting. And go back to the 50s, it was very much everything was in the closet. And if you dared go out of the closet, especially in proper, polite society, you kind of risked ruining your life, and you risked your family and your income sometimes. Now, one of the things I kind of liked about Carol is it, again, doesn't beat you over the head with this. It takes a while for this relationship to blossom. And it's not overly judgmental about it. It doesn't make the straw men either, because it's very easy to make a movie like this and just say, look at these homophobes out there and they just hate it and we're so much more enlightened because we live in 2015. But that doesn't do that. It shows the prevailing attitudes at the time. But the biggest problem that these characters face isn't necessarily the nature of their relationship. It's more where they fall in society, and not even as much Rooney Mara's character of Therese. She's kind of unaffected by the scandal of this. It's really Cate Blanchett's character who suffers the most, because she's getting a divorce, and it's a nasty divorce, and it's her soon-to-be ex-husband who is personally hurt and emotionally hurt because he's being rejected, and he's suffering the humiliation because his wife doesn't love him and can't love him physically. So it's got a lot of these issues there. And I think it plays it relatively evenly for how preachy some of these movies can get. It really plays it really well. Now, the other thing that's really noticeable in it, beyond the acting performances, because both Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara do fantastic jobs in this, and they're the ones to watch, and they work as leads. Although I think they're pushing Rooney Mara as a supporting character, even though it's really both of their movie. But one of the other things to really note about this movie is the cinematography is fantastic. And the reason it's important to note is it was shot on Super 16. I can't remember the last movie that was this slick that was actually shot in Super 16. You really don't see Super 16 anymore. You don't see 16 millimeter much anymore anyways, because that was a choice prior to digital. You know, it's way more expensive to do 16 millimeter than it is to do digital. But it looks gorgeous. I was stunned when I found out it was actually shot in Super 16 rather than 35 millimeter or digital. It looks that good. And it just is rich and it's beautiful. And I mean, it has Cincinnati playing New York, because it's New York in like 1952, so. But it's a gorgeous looking movie, and it's a real interesting comparison. Yeah, you've got like Hateful Eight out there, which is shot in 70 millimeter, but I think this is an interesting juxtaposition to something like The Revenant, which is a gorgeously shot digital movie. But this shows that there's a real artistry still left in film. It's just, even though it's a dying breed, there's a lot of love that can be given to this. So Carol's a good movie. It's an interesting movie. It's a very well-done movie, and it's going to live through award season. So keep your eye on this one. Carol kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to answer a listener voicemail. I'm going to talk about the box office, and I'm also going to have the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr, rolling into the final segment of Fat Guys at the Movies. Don't go just yet, because I've got a couple more things to talk about. First of all, let me answer this listener voicemail from our good friend, Thomas from Seattle.
I have another Star Wars-related question. My girlfriend and I were watching the new Star Wars trailer the other day, and she looked at me and she goes, "You know, Harrison Ford is not a great actor." And to me, those were like fighting words, because he's always been one of my favorite actors, even though I know like the last 10 or 15 years have been pretty much throwaway movies, most of them. But then I was like thinking about what she said. I was like, you know, he's not the best actor. He has a certain kind of role he can play well, but when he strays outside of that narrow range, he has to have movies where it's almost painful to watch him act. So it made me confront my like childhood favorite actor not being like a great actor. And I was kind of a little shocked, but I think it's kind of true. So I was just wondering, what do you think about Harrison Ford? And if you agree, it's like, where did his career go wrong? And what could he have done over those last 15 years to, you know, maybe had a slightly better later half of his career?
That's an interesting question. It really doesn't have to do with anything about Star Wars, aside from the fact that Harrison Ford's in it, and the Star Wars trailer is sort of what sparked this discussion. But it's something I don't hear a lot of people acknowledging all that often. This is not a hit on Harrison Ford. This is not me saying that people don't acknowledge that Harrison Ford's not that great of an actor. But I think what you've got here is a case of movie star charisma. And you're right, Thomas. Harrison Ford is not a terribly versatile actor. He was great as Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And he's had some pretty solid roles outside of those franchises. Stuff like Jack Ryan in like Clear and Present Danger. He was really good in Witness. So we've seen Harrison Ford in a lot of stuff. And he's very, very good in it. Now, lately, he's gotten very old and grumpy. I mean, pretty much since the mid-90s, everything he's done has been an old grumpy man. I mean, even if you go and you look at something like 6 Days, 7 Nights, which isn't a great movie, it's entertaining enough, it's passable. But Harrison Ford in 6 Days, 7 Nights, that's, I think, the first movie where I was like, wow, he really is just a grumpy old man, isn't he? And he continues through that. And you watch movies like Morning Glory, which is a sweet little movie, but he plays the grumpy old man in that film. That's kind of what he settled into. He was sort of like the roguish scoundrel in the 70s and 80s. And now he's the grumpy old man. Now, yeah, I grew up with Harrison Ford as well. He was one of the bona fide movie stars of my childhood. But I'll be the first to admit, he's not a terribly versatile actor, which essentially means he's not a good actor. Being a good actor is somebody like Mandy Patinkin, or Jeffrey Rush, or Gary Oldman. These are actors that will become another character. Daniel Day-Lewis. You can't look at Daniel Day-Lewis's characters that he's played and be like, oh, that's a typical Daniel Day-Lewis character, aside from the fact that it's usually bizarre or different. A good actor becomes the role they play. A good actor can play anything. And we've seen some really great performances by some great actors. And there are some actors that generally play kind of a stock role and then they break out of it. And that's very impressive. But if you think of the iconic movie stars really aren't great actors. They're very good at playing a very specific type of character. Julia Roberts is a great example of that. She has tried to act in many films. And oftentimes when she's working outside of that comfort zone, she can be really awful. I mean, look at Mary Riley, for example. She's hideous in that movie. Even in Secret in Their Eyes, which came out a couple weeks ago, and she's pretty good in that one, you can still tell it's Julia Roberts trying to act. Or take, for example, Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson is one of my favorite guys to watch on screen. I would never accuse him of being a great actor. Give him a role that's made for him, something like Jack Torrance in The Shining, or even as the masochistic dentist patient in Little Shop of Horrors. He's great in those roles because he's Jack Nicholson. But I can't tell you I've ever seen him act as anything but Jack Nicholson. Morgan Freeman, another one. Morgan Freeman plays Morgan Freeman. Now he's great if you got him as Morgan Freeman. But there's that one scene in Wanted where he busts out the F-bomb trying to be Lawrence Fishburne, and it doesn't work because he's Morgan Freeman. Sandra Bullock, same thing. She won an Oscar for essentially playing snarky Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side. But if you look at her performance in The Blind Side and her performance in All About Steve, for which she won the Razzie the same year, really not a whole big difference. It's more a construct of the movie they're in. But like I said, the really good actors are the ones that nobody remembers as an iconic actor. They're the ones who blend, who become so many different characters. I mean, go all the way back. Bela Lugosi was an iconic actor. He wasn't particularly a great actor on the American cinema scene. He could play a very limited role. Or Dwight Fry, who played Fritz and Renfield in the original Universal horror movies. That guy was great at playing the nutcase, but he wasn't exactly a versatile actor. So is Harrison Ford a great actor? No. Is he a great stock actor? Does he give you a performance that if you're looking for a Harrison Ford type performance, are you going to get a great performance? Yeah, pretty much. Now, what could he have done? I don't think he really cares. I think Harrison Ford was just playing around. He doesn't need the money. He's just doing it to keep busy, I think, to get away from Calista Flockhart occasionally. Thanks for your voicemail, Thomas. Talk to you again soon, I'm sure. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Now, my prediction was that The Good Dinosaur would win the weekend. It did not. The weekend, the actual weekend, was won by The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2 at $52 million. I thought it was going to drop a little bit far, but it still did drop about 50%. And then there's The Good Dinosaur with almost $40 million, which is still pretty good. It's on the low end of Pixar, but the low end of Pixar is still really pretty great. And Creed did extremely well with almost $30 million. Creed made $42 million over the entire holiday. The Good Dinosaur made $55 million over the entire holiday. Did very well. Both of these movies did very well. Victor Frankenstein, however, bombed. Embarrassingly so. It didn't even make the top 10. It made over the weekend $2.5 million. Over the entire holiday, it only made $3.6 million. It made less than $1 million a day for a holiday release. And I think that has nothing to do with the characters or the story. I think it has completely everything to do with the marketing of dropping a Halloween-themed movie on Thanksgiving weekend against some pretty heavy competition at that. This week, what do I think is going to happen? It's probably going to be Hunger Games again. I'd love to see Krampus win. I want to say $30 million for Krampus just to buck trends. I know that's completely bonkers, but I want something to knock off Mockingjay. It's probably going to be Mockingjay with around $25 to $30 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The big release this week was just on the heels of Turkey Day, and that was Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 34. Again, one of the greatest shows ever on television. It's got three Mike episodes in it. There were a lot fewer Joel episodes than Mike episodes, but you still get four classic episodes, War of the Colossal Beast, which is the sequel to The Amazing Colossal Man. You've got Viking Women and the Sea Serpent, which is a fantastic one. Now, that's the Joel episode, and this is one that's most famous for all the sketches having to do with waffles. This is the essence of a Joel episode, as compared to the Mike episodes. And yeah, you know, like War of the Colossal Beast was when he was still dealing with TV's Frank and Deep 13. But there was a very different timbre between Mike and Joel. And they're very different types of episodes. And the Viking Women and the Sea Serpent is a great example of a Joel episode that kind of hit that Saturday morning goofiness, whereas the Mike stuff was a little more irreverent. It's a great comparison piece. There's also The Undead, which is a very early Sci-Fi Channel episode with Mike, when they're still sort of struggling with their host segments, trying to figure out what the wraparound story is going to be. It's the early episodes with Brain Guy, the Observer. And then there's She Creature, which is another Mike episode, a much later one. So it's a great 4-episode collection. Some of these you've probably never seen before. Some of them have never been on video before. So always worth picking up one of those MST3K discs before the new show gets started again. So that's always great. The other ones I want to hit, we've also got Amy. That's the documentary about Amy Winehouse. Pretty well done movie, especially if you're an Amy Winehouse fan. Mistress America, Noah Baumbach's latest film with Greta Gerwig, who is probably the better part of the movie than Noah Baumbach. And then 90 Minutes in Heaven, which I already talked about before. It exists. It's there. It's terrible. But you may like it. That's it for this week. I need to go. And next week, I'm going to be talking about In the Heart of the Sea, The Big Short, and Legend. It's award season on Fat Guys at the Movies. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.